Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. I am Gary Gramling.
I'm Jenny Rentis.
I'm Connor Orr.
And this is the Friday special. This is the opening game special. I think it was a really good game. I thought it was a really entertaining game. A little bit sloppy, but a little bit sloppy is nice sometimes. And if you liked good quarterback play, you got really good quarterback play tonight. I have no complaints.
It was a much better game than I was anticipating. And I have to say, I probably underestimated Dak Prescott's recovery and return. You know, despite the great story Greg Bishop did about his road back, the shoulder injury in camp and his having to sit out for 2 weeks really kind of spooked me. Would he be rusty? But he was tremendous, and it was obviously a down-to-the-wire game, which was certainly more than I expected.
I think for me, and we'll obviously get into this, but it was stunning to just to see the direction that Dallas ended up going so quickly out of the gate, the fearlessness with which they put the entire game plan on his shoulders, and then, you know, yada yada, Tom Brady wins, and you know, that's just, you know, some of the other stuff that happens. So
that's just the order of the universe.
Correct, yeah.
So we only have one game to discuss here, but we have a really full show. We're gonna run through the game. We're gonna run through the quarterbacks. We're gonna through the defensive performances here, and some of the flaws in those groups. We had some wacky stuff happen. We had some cringeworthy commentating, which has sort of become the norm with a certain player in the league. And we are gonna talk a little bit with TJ Watt at the end. We'll talk some of the other developments from Thursday's news cycle, and we are also not ready to let go of Connor's, let's just call it what it is, an about face on his Brown Super Bowl prediction. But now that I've sort of created this tension,
yeah, I know that the Browns are going to win the Super Bowl.
That's a clip from not even a week ago. That's a clip from like 5 days ago.
I know that the Browns are going to win the Super Bowl. So let me first thank both producer Shelby and one of our very loyal listeners, Matthew Golden, who clipped this and sent it in, and just sort of a really alarming moment for me. When apparently at the beginning of the podcast, I said that the Browns were going to win the Super Bowl, and then 35 minutes later, completely denied it. And, you know, I know that the Browns are going to win the Super Bowl. caused a lot of self-examination on my part. You know, you Google things like, am I a narcissist? You know, is there something going on here? What kind of people can say something and then 35 minutes later completely deny its existence? And so, tough one for old Connor today.
Yeah. It's going to take a lot of time to rebuild trust among the podcast hosts, Connor, but we're willing to work on the relationship if you are.
And just to be clear, we're not done with it.
I know that the Browns are going to win the Super Bowl. Do you know when this is a horrible thing to be aligning myself with at this point in history, but like when a politician or like a controversial TV news personality is like, well, I never said that, and then there's like eight clips of them afterwards saying exactly that. I'm not identifying with these people, but I was 110% certain that I didn't say what I said half an hour after I said it. So let that be a lesson to all of you out there, is to think before you speak, but also listen to yourself when you're talking.
There you go. Good advice, and one that we'll revisit later in the show here.
That the Browns are going to win the Super Bowl.
We are starting with the game they just played. And the quarterback play. And we'll start with Brady and the Bucs. it's funny, if you kind of rewind back to early December, they had that Monday night game against the Rams at home where they just got, I mean, their offense was outclassed. And, you know, Brady at one point was on a streak where he was 0-for-19 in a row on passes longer than 20 yards in the air. And they just looked disjointed. It looked like it wasn't going to work out. It didn't quite click. They sort of beat up on some bad teams. It got to the postseason. It still didn't look like a great offense until the Super Bowl. They kind of just changed gears, and it just looked like a Tom Brady offense instead of a Bruce Arians offense, if we're putting it bluntly. And it looked like that tonight, and it was a really good-looking offense.
Yeah, I think the turning point for the Bucs last season was what Brady and Bruce Arians called like a meeting of the minds. But it was essentially Arians relenting to Brady later in the season and putting aspects of the scheme that he'd played in for two decades in New England first. And I think we saw a lot of that magic in the Super Bowl, particularly, you know, the connection between Brady and Gronkowski that can't really be schemed up in any playbook, right? We saw that in the Super Bowl win, and we also saw that tonight because that one touchdown to Gronkowski was exactly that. And you heard Brady tell the NBC broadcast after the game that that comes from playing together so much. There was another clip of Brady where it seemed like Byron Leftwich sent in a call that Brady didn't like, and he was saying, no, no, no. It was the catch by Godwin, I think, right? That set up the game-winning field goal. So clearly, Brady has a lot of agency and authority to run the offense how he wants it to be run. And that won them a Super Bowl last year. And evidently, they're still building on it this year.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that, I mean, you know, this is a New England Patriots team, right? I mean, they're going to come out and they're going to run duo and they're going to smash opponents. And especially situationally with Dallas, they struggle with their defensive interior. And so that's what they did. They just double teamed all these guys and they just plowed the ball forward. And but I thought it was really interesting that they did sort of like get a little creative, a little bit more finesse and clever than I thought that they were capable of being. And, you know, I was looking at just sort of how they were using personnel in the first half and, you know, did a lot of, you know, double tight end stuff on the field. And then all of a sudden, when they're inside the red zone, when it makes sense to load up on all your tight ends, that's when they brought out the 11 personnel, the three or four, you know, wide receiver sets, and really was messing with the Cowboys. And I thought that was super clever. It was it was different than what we saw from Tampa, but also vintage Brady in that it's so unique to the matchups, and that kind of had all of his fingerprints all over it.
It feels like that Super Bowl 53 Patriots offense right now, when they sort of went through that run where it was a lot of Sony Michel, and then they built a lot of play action off of it, and you know, that's kind of, that was their identity. And it looks like they're starting to build a similar identity there in Tampa and building off of what they did last February. We do have to talk about sort of the controversy of the night as far as the officiating goes. We'll just go around the horn here. Offensive pass interference on the Chris Godwin catch that set up the winning field goal, or not offensive pass interference, which is how they ruled it on the field.
I'm going to wait for Jenny to answer because I know that she she's right. Yeah. So then I'm going to kind of like, I'm going to fall in strategically behind there and sort of ride the, I'm going to sort of draft off the response because I know it's going to be correct.
Well, that puts a lot of pressure on me. And you're only saying that I'm right because I unearthed some of the receipts from the Browns podcast earlier in the day. But I would say my ruling on this is that it was probably OPI, but it wasn't called because there wasn't full extension of Godwin's arm. And we were rewatching the clip right before we began recording, and the angle on the broadcast was not the best angle to determine. But as Gary said, our takeaway in the moment was that Godwin's arm wasn't fully extended. So in that situation, it's very hard for the official to call OPI if from his viewpoint, and I don't think Godwin's arm was fully extended. And usually that's the indicator that officials look at for OPI.
Exactly. That's totally what I was going to say. Perfect response.
No, I think on the podcast we will keep an open mind if another angle is showed that there was full extension of the arm. It just kind of, on based on that replay that NBC kept on showing, it looked like the arms were tangled, and there was probably a ever so slight push, but not, you know, not full extension. I'm not quite sure where that came from on the broadcast, because the camera angles we saw did not show that. Could have happened, but we didn't see it.
I could have used one of those fun, well, I guess it's Fox that does that, right, where they just get right up into the play with those, like, 5K HD cameras, you know. Yeah. I could have used one of those, you know. We could have used something fun there, but it was lacking a little bit.
It's amazing with the with the plethora of camera angles that they have that we didn't see a better angle on that. But that's where we sit right now, and the stance of this podcast is the no call was more correct than throwing the flag there. Chris Godwin had, you know, he ended up having a big night, 9 for 105 and a touchdown. He was briefly shaping up to be the GOAT, the bad version of the GOAT of this game, and then ends up redeeming himself there. And you know, Jenny touched on the Brady Gronkowski connection there, and Antonio Brown was a force in this game. I mean, Anthony Brown could not match up with him. They went after that one. Anthony Brown, I'm assuming when we look at the All-22, we're going to see a lot of safety help for Anthony Brown in the second half of this game, and that's probably how they ended up sort of, you know, surviving to an extent with AB out there. But Antonio Brown looked like he was playing at the level he was playing at in Pittsburgh, and that's the football story on Antonio Brown. And I'm not sure why we had another telecast that sort of insisted on, I don't know, creating some sort of redemption arc with him that just doesn't really exist.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Gary. Certainly, there may not be the time and space in a broadcast every time that Antonio Brown does something on the football field that matters to go into his lengthy legal history, into, you know, the circumstances under which he was brought into the Buccaneers last year, right? He was still serving an 8-game suspension, which did not even include the rape allegation that was made against him. That civil suit was settled out of court in this offseason, and to date, there hasn't been an NFL punishment specifically for that. But at the bare minimum, then just don't discuss any off-the-field stuff, right? Don't have a fluffy quote about his friendship with Tom Brady and, you know, how they brought him in and were able to revive his career after everything that had happened. Like, you can't touch on things like that without talking about the broader context. And the reality is, when the Bucks brought him in, like, they didn't really do any vetting. Like, I asked Jason Light, the general manager, before the Super Bowl last year, because he said, oh, we did our due diligence. I said, what did that due diligence entail? And he wouldn't tell me. Now, maybe there's things that they did that are really thorough and really good, but we know how this generally goes in the football world. The vetting that they do is, will he fit into our locker room? And is he going to be friends with the quarterback? And Tom Brady stood on the table for them to bring Antonio Brown in. And we saw in the Super Bowl, and we saw tonight, why that was. Because Antonio Brown is a very talented football player. So the conversation about Brown, if you can't talk about all of the other stuff, and you can't put the necessary detail and context into the conversation, then just focus on what he did on the football field.
Yeah, this is a broadcast crew that has stumbled pretty mercilessly through some bad moments over the last couple of years. I mean, there was like the snorting on Al Michaels' part during the opener last year when there was the unveiling of all the social justice initiatives, and like, you know, they were brushing that off as like all the stuff that happened over the summer, and it's like, well, no, that wasn't just stuff, you know, that was, you know, very, you know, that was big, you know, country and world altering events that were happening here that affected a lot of people. And he, Chris Collinsworth used that word again tonight with Antonio Brown. I'm just pulling it up. Just some stuff off the field with Antonio Brown, just some stuff, you know, not like an accusation of rape or something like that, that was settled out of court. You know, that's not stuff. And I think it's pretty miraculous that they're able to just continue to pinball their way through these things without anybody, you know, poking their head in there and saying, you know, to your point, are we really going to try to have a conversation about this, or are we just going to let you guys know that, like, from now on, we're not going to even try to blend the off-field stuff because you can't do it with any modicum of sensibility?
Yeah, and look, at Sports Illustrated, we did the most in-depth and sort of definitive reporting on that quote-unquote stuff, and I have no problem with Antonio Brown playing in the NFL. I think there has to be a path to redemption for everyone in some way, shape, or form. And I'm just speaking for myself at the moment, but that redemption involves some sort of recognition of what you did and why it was wrong. And he has not taken that step. He's apologized for some of his behavior, but especially when it comes to his treatment of women, which was so hugely problematic, he has not taken responsibility for that in any way, shape, or form. And that's why it's look, if you have to do shorthand on it and say, you know, read up on it on the internet, go Google it, go find out what happened, because you're calling a game and the next play is coming up. That's something that you have to deal with in TV. I guess we don't work in TV, but when you sort of cram in, you know, why is Michelle Tafoya getting the sort of, you know, that again, that convoluted redemption arc quote from him to roll out during the game? Why is that pre-reported? We didn't get that on Chris Godwin. He's a really good player. Is Chris Godwin not friends with Tom Brady? You could do that with him. It doesn't make sense with Antonio Brown. It's not fair to do that with Antonio Brown because he did not earn that redemption arc. He's a really good player. He's back in the league. That's the Antonio Brown story.
I think that's well said. I mean, Chris Godwin, his first introduction to Brady was Brady signs and sends him an Instagram DM. And Chris Godwin is like, why is Brady sending me an Instagram DM? That's a fun story to share in a podcast or a broadcast, excuse me. So, like, you could go that route, right? I mean, but instead they went this route, which is something that we see again and again with broadcasts, and it minimizes allegations, it minimizes bad behavior. And like you said, Gary, there haven't been many signs of remorse. And when these issues or these questions about these quote unquote issues came up prior to the Super Bowl, Brown was, you know, bothered that he was being asked, right? He has mandated availability before the Super Bowl, which is generally more than a player does in the regular season. So he was asked harder and, you know, more questions that would hold him more accountable than he'd faced all season. And it was all about how he'd gone through a bunch of things. It wasn't about, he didn't express remorse or, you know, he didn't seem like it was an opportunity for him to say, I've done X, Y, and Z to grow from this. No, rather he was, you know, focusing on what he himself had been through to get to this point. And that is not reflective of a person who has worked to earn a second chance.
It's just, you know, they kept going back to it. You know, they went back to it like multiple times over the course of the broadcast. And it's just like, you know, no producer just wanted to stick their head in there and be like, hey guys, just, you know, let's just say first down and move on. Like, not like, and another thing about how great this situation is, you know, like, you know, nobody there thought to just kind of pop in there real quick and say, hey, let's just stop this all together.
Apparently not. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we will be back with the rest of this game and some lighter fare, if we're being honest. All right, so look, the start of the show probably would have been Dak Prescott if the Cowboys held on to win this game. They didn't, so he's back in the, I don't know, I'm going to call this a B block. I don't know if that's proper terminology, but we'll just say it is. This is the B block of the show. So Dak, I don't know about you guys, when he came up short on that throw to CeeDee Lamb on that first drive, it was sort of a, you know, outside the numbers throw, and he just came up way short on it, and it was kind of like, ooh, this might be a long night here. But no, it was not.
Yeah, it was interesting to see Dak Prescott like there was a couple of those throws, like you said, that were really indicative of like, oh no, like, you know, there's still something not right here. But then it was almost, I have it written down, there was one specific throw, I think, to Gallup before he got hurt in the end zone, where he had underthrown that exact throw like twice in the game, in the game already, like the same route, but it just in different locations on the field. And then that one was just perfect, like almost like beyond perfect in terms of exactly where you'd want to put that ball. And so that was one of those things where, you know, when you were watching, it was like, okay, this is going to be fine. You know, some of the other situational usage of him, I probably, if I was Mike McCarthy, would have eliminated all zone read keepers for at least another week. There are coaches out there who are bolder than I am, and that's why they're NFL head coaches. So,
I think also early in the game, he did look tentative moving around at all, right? And I thought later in the game, he seemed more comfortable with his legs. So I was really impressed. As I said earlier in the show, perhaps I underestimated the Dak Prescott that we would be able to see coming off the injury last season and then having to sit out for part of camp. It didn't look like he was a quarterback who had rust. He was going toe-to-toe with Tom Brady. And he got better as the game went on. So, and they also didn't have Zach Martin in the game, and he was on the COVID reserve list, expect likely to be back for the next game. And so I think it's impressive, too, for Dak Prescott to play that well when he's missing his best lineman.
Yeah, it was... I thought he moved around a little bit tentatively. That one zone read call felt like one of those zone read calls that you do with like Kirk Cousins or something, and maybe the defense completely sells out, and then he can just run untouched for 15 yards. And when that didn't happen, he did look, you know, I mean, whatever. It's in our heads too. So, but he did look like, you know, that might be a run where he lowered his shoulder maybe a year ago, but you know, he just sort of took the 2 yards and called it a day, which. I mean, I think we're all kind of thankful for that when it's all said and done. But I thought he made a couple of really impressive throws in the second half when they were coming at him with slot blitzes. And when you're, you know, when you're talking about arm strength, look, if you have a clean pocket, you can step into a throw. Pretty much anyone in the NFL can look like they have great arm strength. He made a couple of throws with, you know, not incredible like Josh Allen, Patrick Mahomes zip, but really good zip. Outside the numbers throws on plays where he had a guy coming into his waist and couldn't step into it. And that was, I thought it was just all sorts of really positive signs here for Dak. And yeah, maybe he's not 100%, but you know, by week 6, no one will be. So he's, it looks like he's just going to be fine at this point.
Yeah. In an interesting way, like, kind of think it's and to your point, like, he targeted CD Lamb, I think, on almost half of his dropbacks throughout like the first three quarters of the first three quarters, and CD Lamb had like a basically a 50% catch rate. And so those numbers get better over the course of a season where, you know, CD Lamb's not going to drop half of the balls that he's going to drop. And so I think that really the statistics would bear out an even better night than we probably thought of for Dak Prescott in general. But yeah, I think it's fascinating because I think it also puts a lot more onus on Mike McCarthy now because, okay, you know, this isn't a rehabilitating season. You have a top 3, 4, 5 quarterback. So the expectation is you got to win that division. If you don't win the NFC East, I think you're in a lot of trouble there.
Yeah, there was the Lamb underthrow. There was the... There was the one really ill-advised throw he made that maybe Levante David should have made the pick on, which, Connor, you know that from your Bucks linebacker reporting.
I know I couldn't tweet it fast enough, you know, for the two people who would have favorited it. I'm sorry, Mom.
Me and Jenny.
Yeah.
yeah, three.
but, yeah, that was Todd Bowles told me that... Levante David told him he had hands like Allstate, but Todd came to find out that Levante was the one who needed insurance. So and that his dropped interceptions are a regular source of comedic banter between the two, and that Levante actually gets really pissed when he drops interceptions, as I'm sure most people do. But you know, so it was an interesting little side note there.
Yeah, he bounced his helmet off the turf after that happened. There was also the throw into the end zone where he and the receiver seemed to be on different pages about where the ball placement should be. In those cases, sometimes it's hard to tell if it's on the quarterback or the receiver. But the DB, was that Davis? Was the DB on that play?
It was Carlton Davis who didn't.
Yeah, he had a chance to pick that one off and didn't. But that was also another sort of off connection there.
I just want to make clear before we move on, Todd Bowles probably delivered that joke a lot better than you just did, Connor. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. It was, and he has, like, that's the thing. Like, he always has the monotone, and so I didn't realize it was a joke until, like, maybe, like, a minute later. And then, but then you can't, so then I didn't laugh, and then the conversation just sort of hits a lull, and I'm annoying to talk to anyway, and so I'm sure he was like, you know, he was like, man, let's just get this guy off the phone, and but he was very, very gracious with his time, so, yeah.
Total deadpan humor with Todd Bowles.
Yes. Yeah, you just gotta be prepared, and I'm being honest. I don't have the attention span for it. I don't.
you're taking notes like Levante David sells insurance.
great story. This guy's got an off-season gig. I mean,
if we didn't have tape
NFL
recorders,
yeah.
If we didn't have tape recorders in this business, I would be in so much trouble. So much trouble. Just like a legal burden amount of trouble.
I mean, just tell the people you're interviewing that you don't even listen to what you say, as we know.
Oh, man.
I'm never going to live this down.
All right, well, let's talk about the defensive side of the ball. And look, the Cowboys still have their issues, and you don't want to draw any huge conclusions off of a loss on opening night to a Bucs offense that, as we discuss, is getting to be really, really good. We saw their issues in, you know, cornerback sort of quality depth, and Anthony Brown seems like he's you know, sort of been teetering on that third cornerback caliber level for quite a while, and sometimes when it goes bad, it just goes really bad with him. So we saw that tonight, and we saw some green moments from Micah Parsons, but I thought overall you could be somewhat optimistic if you're a Cowboys fan about the way that group looked tonight.
Yeah, I think that's right, Gary. I know you're big on turnovers kind of ebb and flow, and you can do things to create turnovers, but it doesn't always work. But clearly a big part of the Cowboys defense looking pretty good tonight and certainly keeping the team in the game was forcing turnovers. I think they had four turnovers.
Yep.
One was DeMarcus Lawrence punching the ball out. That was a great play. We saw Diggs catching a deflection off Fournette's hands. You know, it seemed like a unit that was coached by Dan Quinn, like a lot of energy. I'm sure he has his own. What was his thing that time we visited Falcons camp? Like, the ball is everything, Connor. So, you know, everyone has their little tips and tricks for, you know, preaching that to players. But as far as a debut for a defensive coordinator after a team or a unit that came off a historically bad season, I thought it was pretty good, all things considered.
I thought it was very good. And, you know, for Micah Parsons to kind of get roasted the way he was, you know, I think that's going to eventually look bad on us, because, you know, I'm not one of these like all 22 evangelists or anything, but we're going off of a TV broadcast. We don't have the full concept of what the play looks like. And, you know, that first catch that he gave up to Rob Gronkowski, he wasn't turned around, but he was in front of Rob Gronkowski. It was a great throw. Yeah. I mean, that was a throw that was like 15 years in the making, and I don't know any linebacker that's stopping that, because Tom Brady and Rob Gronkowski can throw around any defender in football. And, you know, okay, a couple times he gets sucked in on play action, But, you know, you're being asked to be that versatile player that more often than not is shooting inside anyway. And so it's going to be hard for you to temper those instincts initially in your first professional game. And I'm sure that they picked on that a little bit, but I don't think this is a lost cause by any stretch of the imagination. And on his pass rushes, he actually looked pretty good. So to Jenny's point, I mean, I think that is Dan Quinn's fingerprints all over it. And that's why you bring in someone like that and feel comfortable drafting a linebacker like Parsons in the first round.
You know what didn't look good about the Cowboys defense, or really either team for that matter, is the new numbers. It's going to take me a while to get used to. Like, on the first series, the Bucks first round pick, Joe Tryon Shoyinka, wearing number 9 as a pass rusher, that really threw me. Trevon Diggs wearing 7. I mean, we knew Micah Parsons was wearing 11, but it just looked weird, like seeing it live in a primetime game. Fournette wearing 7. Yeah. I mean, it just, there was a lot going on that was difficult to get used to.
I'm glad you said that, Jenny, because I didn't have the courage to say so. I hate the new numbers. I hate them so much. And I know I'm revealing that I'm 98 years old right now, but oh my God, I despise this. It's making me so upset, and I'll get used to it. But if you play in the front 7 and you're wearing a single digit number, you look ridiculous. Ridiculous. Jalen Smith had a great linebacker number at 54. Can you imagine getting a Jalen Smith 9 jersey now? You would be heckled until my voice was hoarse. It's just such a bad look. I hate it, hate it, hate it.
You know what's great about the single-digit numbers is that the more you complain about it, the more it just feeds my love of it. You know, it's like
wow.
It's like in the 50s, when old people complained about rock music, and then it's like, well, here's a little more Elvis for you, you know, and then you crank up the volume. I would say, Gary, that to your point, and Jenny, to your credit as well, there is no finer tribute to the godfather of this podcast, Andy Benoit, than to on a season opening show rage against numbers not matching positional guidelines, which was a big staple of his during his time here.
That's a great point, Connor.
I can feel him nodding his head during Jenny and my talking points there, which are just very important to make at this point. I can deal with it. Offensive skill position players is fine. I think the running backs look a little bit dumb with the single digit, but whatever. But, oh my God, those guys in the front 7.
That was what really got me. Like, the first stop the Bucks made, right, and the rookie, Joe Tryon Shoyinka, I hope I'm saying that correctly, you know, he puts his hand up, closed fist, fourth down symbol, and I'm like, what's going on here? Is the punter a kicker on the field? And then I'm like, oh no, that is an edge rusher. No, like, someone wearing a single digit shouldn't be holding up the, like, fourth down. Like, it just looks weird.
So is it weird to me that the weirdest one for me was Leonard Fournette? And even though I think he's unarguably more synonymous with 7 than with his NFL number, still to this day. However, the 7 in college was like neatly ironic because he was like so much bigger and more powerful than everybody else. And so it just like looked like funny in a weird sort of way. But now that he went back to it and he's like the same size as everybody else, it doesn't look as cool. I don't know if I'm explaining myself properly, but do you kind of get what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I also think in college, there's like some magic in those numbers because you know they won't be able to wear them in the NFL, right? So it's like, even though you associate him with 7, you associate him with a college 7, not an NFL 7.
I would not have bought back all my jerseys to have done this the following year. As much as I enjoy it, I'm hoping that, you know, a couple quarterbacks do like number 20 or 22. You know, I hope that's a thing that we can at some point start to get that. I see Gary just like, there's like a vein bursting in his head.
I'm fighting back tears right now.
But the first time, because Tom Brady was one of the biggest people to come out against it, now that he's allowed to speak in public and actually has some interesting things to say. And the first time he said 11 is the mic was just like a really interesting moment, because, you know, you could tell there's a little bit of disgust on that as well, you know.
Yes.
11 is the mic.
11 should not be the mic.
Just 11 died a little inside.
Should be 55.
55's the mic.
Oh, man. All right. I'm glad we got that out of our system, and it's just going to be an issue forever. But, yeah, the Bucs defensively, look, I thought it was the same Bucs defense for the most part. The Cowboys just, I mean, you know, smartly avoided the strength of this defense. Why do you want to run at Vita Vea with Devin White and Lalonde David behind him when you can't block Vita Vea? I mean, no one can block Vita Vea, but with the shorthanded interior line tonight, it was just a huge mismatch. So they didn't run a whole lot. They threw it to the outside, and the Bucs were a little bit thin after Sean Murphy Bunting went down, and he might be a guy who's out for a while at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the thin secondary is going to be interesting to see how long he's out and how the injuries impact already pretty thin depth back there. But Vita Vea, like, I think he's somebody that kind of, obviously he was hurt for a large part of last season, so I think we didn't see him as this huge factor in the Super Bowl run, but boy, he was everywhere tonight.
Amazing how you could be a GM that you could be the kicker guy, but also the Vita Vea guy, you know? Like, it's, you know, it really is, you know, the NFL, like, you can be forgotten about some horrifically bad decision by making an amazingly good one, you know? And Vita Vea is certainly bailing him out there.
I was going to say, he's the kicker guy, he's the Jameis Winston guy, and he has a Super Bowl ring now. So, yeah. You know, that's the way it goes sometimes. Vita Vea is... He's just unblockable sometimes. And it just, I think it makes just everyone's lives so much easier around him. But yeah, if you're looking for something to worry about on behalf of Bucs fans, because they've just had it too good for too long at this point, secondary depth is probably an issue. You saw a lot of zone coverage for them in the second half. Murphy Bunting is primarily their slot guy. So now you got Ross Cockrell in there, and we'll see how that plays out over the next couple weeks here. But just overall, this is a team that they played a 20-game season in 2020, and now you have a 17-game regular season, and they stayed relatively healthy. They lost Vea for a little bit. They were without, I think Carlton Davis missed a game or two late season. They were without Murphy Bunting for a game or two. But, you know, it's a team that stayed pretty healthy last year, and, you know, if they don't stay healthy this year, maybe that's what sort of evens the field a little bit in the NFC South.
Yeah, because it's rare for a Super Bowl team to bring back all of its starters. I mean, generally, one of the big reasons why it's hard for a team to repeat is because players cash in on having been part of a Super Bowl team and they get big free agency deals elsewhere. I mean, I remember seeing that early on in my career after the 2007 Giants won. Then that offseason, it was just a mass exodus of players, a lot of different places, right? So, but the Bucs didn't have that. But yeah, I mean, if the secondary depth was already thin to begin with, and then they sustain injuries on opening night, that will definitely be a factor.
All right. And so the things that decided this game, like the things that decide a lot of games, are, sort of the weird stuff, the fluky stuff. I think sloppy football is the best football. It's entertaining when there are turnovers. The most boring football in the history of the league was when Tom Brady was at his absolute height and he'd just carve up defense and be like, oh, great, gonna watch this guy take another three-step drop and, like, throw an eight-yard pass to Edelman and just march down the field. That's boring. It's the same thing. You want to see some chaos. That's why it's nice that they keep on insisting that Leonard Fournette can catch the football when he has just displayed again and again. He cannot. He had two drops tonight. The one turned into an interception. When he catches the ball, it just looks like he's like, I don't know. He's trying to pop it or something. He's trying to punch it. I don't know what's going on there, but yeah, I think maybe the Cowboys stuck around because they might have been on the better end of the number of flukes in this game. But either way, you know, just added a little bit of spice to this one.
To Jenny's point, the game was just was more spicy than I expected, and as somebody who writes off of these games and likes when there's a vast point differential so I can form a quick conclusion at the end of the first quarter and then complete the writing midway through the third quarter so that you can enjoy the fourth quarter with a little bit of popcorn, not have to do anything. You know, wasn't my favorite, you know, this one came down to the wire, but you know, in a good way. I think we were all ready for that, you know, unless the Eagles-Jets preseason Hail Mary got you fired up enough for football that satiated you to this point.
Greg Zuerlein also just lived 1,000 lifetimes tonight.
It's amazing.
We were writing his career obit at, like, 9:30 Eastern time, and then he was almost the hero.
I mean, we were saying on the group chat that some of his early struggles could potentially open the door for an X factor like Michael Badgley to come in. But by the end of the game, Greg Zuerlein redeemed himself. But then you have the feeling like, okay, I turned it around. I kick what I think could be, or, well, you hope is the game-winning field goal. And then, of course, the Bucks get the ball back.
It's the way it goes with Tom Brady.
Yeah, too much time, right?
To me, the biggest letdown of the night, and we are established, this podcast is firmly in the pro-Baker Mayfield progressive commercial camp. We discussed that a couple of weeks ago here. So I was really excited when I saw them roll out that new one. I don't think it worked. I think it was bad. And I am someone who would absolutely, if they made an Uncle Drew-style movie based on, like, Baker Mayfield living in that stadium, I would watch it. I mean, I'd turn the lights off and, like, pull down the shades and make sure no one could see me watching it. But I'd watch the entire thing, and I'd love it. Tonight's commercial, though, just wasn't right. He's got to be, like, frustrated and angry, and he was kind of like, you know, they played up, like, the gossipy neighbor thing. It was a bummer. It was a miss.
I will agree with you on that, and I have to say, embarrassingly so, like, I was slow to come around. Connor recognized the genius of these commercials very early on last season, and it took me a little while to get there, and then I'm now fully in. But yes, I did not like the gossipy neighbor one. I also feel like it had played out tropes and stereotypes of suburban moms, et cetera, et cetera. However, there was the other new one, the yard sale one, right? And I liked that one. I thought that one was good.
Yeah, I would say, you know, if you're the script writers at Progressive, I mean, you know, not everything is going to be the White Album, but, you know, everything, you know, I think you're going to be close. And I just say give it time. I mean, we're just now beginning to let that Baker Mayfield character explore his space. And after the Browns win the Super Bowl this year, there will be plenty of time for him to act in more commercials and really really develop the character. So
I know that the Browns are going to win the Super Bowl.
Can I just say, because it's come back around, and we've also touched on the Michael Badgley thing, and we do have a couple more things to get to on this show before we wrap up, but I just want to say, I want to tell you my theory on Connor's, let's call it enthusiasm for the Michael Badgley anger, because like any good magician or illusionist, if you will, the ruse, like the chicanery, it was all about the misdirection. And wow. I was kind of wondering, like, why is Connor so upset over this perfectly normal choice of Michael Badgley as our Guess Who X Factor? There was no real controversy, but he kind of ginned up this huge controversy and just sort of built into it. And, I mean, I'm wondering, I'm going to do my social media forensics. I'm going to find out where all these accounts that were, like, you know, in my mentions when Michael Badgley got cut And I wouldn't be surprised if some of them were maybe created in the last 3 weeks, and maybe if you were going to do the geo tracking, possibly somewhere in the state of New Jersey. And I'll just flat out slander you at this point, Connor. I think you were just building up. You wanted to escape the Browns Super Bowl prediction, and this was your plan, and you were found out, and here we are.
This is the face of a guy who's melting down live on Zoom, and I never envisioned my career coming down in flames this way, but I think that people who ride the lightning as long as I have, they don't think about being caught, and I was caught, so it's tough. It's a tough situation, but I still maintain that. Listing Michael Badgley, a currently unemployed NFL player, as an X factor was a more egregious decision than to forget what I said half an hour ago. Again, I don't know. I could see also why people are bad at apologies. Like, I'm not.
If I offended you, if I misled you, that's the road you're going down, Connor. I also want to make clear to listeners that the first time you made the Browns will win the Super Bowl prediction was actually in June, because when all of this came up, I was like, all right, let me go back to the AFC North preview episode. And that's where you said the Browns have as good a chance as anyone of winning the Super Bowl, something along the lines, like, I think they'll win the Super Bowl. I did not even realize that you said it at the top of the most recent show, which Shelby and the listener who wrote into you subsequently pointed out. So really, Connor, this was really just a remarkable situation.
I mean, I'll just say this. I'm not in your shoes right now, Connor, and I'm glad I'm not. But can you take some comfort in the fact that the people who love you are the ones who are basically tearing you down right now, that it's me and Jenny and our wonderful producer, Shelby Royston, who, by the way, pointed out that that clip he keeps dropping in was 46 seconds into the last show.
Oh, my God. No, there's no
know that the Browns are going to win the Super Bowl.
No, it's not. There's nothing comforting about not remembering that you said something half an hour after you said it. Like, I think that there are, I don't know if any of you had ever watched that show on Showtime called The Affair. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes. I watched season one and maybe half of season two.
Is that the Dominic West show?
Right. And so the whole premise of the show is it's like basically like 10 minutes of an event that is seen by, but it, through the perspectives of like three different people, right? And so in each different character's recollection, other characters are wearing different things and they're acting in a slightly different way. And so, you know, at first I was just like, that's a neat way to tell a story. And now I'm like, this is sort of my life, because I have no idea, you know, what came out of my mouth at the beginning of this episode. I don't know. Did I say that, you know, Mike McCarthy was going to get fired at the end of the year? I don't know what I said. And it's a little scary. So, you know, I'm going to have to start just like taking notes a little bit.
Well, you know what you can take comfort in, Connor? You might not listen to yourself, but Gary and I listen to you.
It's true, buddy. You're surrounded in love and also people who are really taking pleasure in
making you look like a jag off.
Comes from a place of love, though. All right, before we go, and we have a lot more of this to come on Monday, probably not a whole lot more about the Browns stuff, but we're going to talk about the Browns Chiefs game. We got a lot of games to talk about.
The Browns are going to win the Super Bowl.
We got a lot of games to talk about coming up on the Monday morning show. Subscribe to the feed now, and it will be in your phone first thing Monday morning. It's just wonderful technology. I don't know why I said it that way, because everyone knows how podcasts work, but I just want to reiterate that. But we had some news outside of this game. TJ Watt signs his extension. So he's going to stay in Pittsburgh for the foreseeable future, which, look, it's expected, but I'm not sure people understand just how just how valuable TJ Watt is, as opposed to just, you know, yes, best player on a really good defense, but it's a little more than that with him.
Yeah, you know what's interesting, Gary? When we wrote a story about him last fall, I almost was surprised by, the fact that he was still seemingly a little bit under the radar. Like, I don't think the full NFL appreciated how good he was at the beginning of last season. I think maybe by the end of last season, where he was a Defensive Player of the Year candidate, maybe people had come around to that a little bit more, but it's surprising to me. But maybe it's because, you know, he's J.J. Watt's younger brother. When the Steelers drafted him, I think people thought, oh, this is a reach. He's only getting drafted here because he's a Watt, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know what the reasons were, but he's one of the best players in the NFL, offense or defense. And it was also interesting that his hold in camp didn't get more attention. And it only got more attention the last week or so when it looked like, oh my gosh, the deadline's approaching, is a deal going to get done? And thinking back on it now, perhaps two reasons why it wasn't, you know, front and center more. Probably one is that it was a hold in, because holdouts are more difficult because teams can't forgive fines now. But also, I think there was probably a sense that the Steelers were going to budge on their longstanding policy of not guaranteeing beyond the signing bonus, right? And that it was just a matter of getting it done. So perhaps it wasn't as big of a deal that he was holding in, because it wasn't like there was a disconnect that wasn't going to be bridged. The Steelers realized they hit on him and they were going to reward him. It just took some time to get the deal done. I don't know. That's just my thoughts on it. But the story we did last year was about his ability as a strip sack artist. Last year, his numbers in that area were down a little bit, but really talking to him about how he studies that specific skill and he recognized that it could be something that he could really thrive at was really indicative, I think, of the way he approaches the game. And Keith Butler, the Steelers defensive coordinator, said, listen, there have been a lot of great outside linebackers here, a lot of great defensive players who can get to the quarterback. Mm-hmm. But he said that Watt obviously does that well. But he said Watt is the best he's seen at stripping the ball and getting the ball out from opposing quarterbacks.
And staying in the AFC North here, the Ravens just had a nightmare summer here. So on Thursday, they lost Marcus Peters to a torn ACL, and obviously that's problematic for that defense, which will probably still be quite good, but Peters was, you know, he's your sort of risk-reward turnover creation guy in the secondary. They also lost Gus Edwards, and I'm not sure if we'd really be highlighting Gus Edwards going down. He's been a fine player the last two seasons, but they were already without J.K. Dobbins and without Justice Hill, who are out for the season. So they are really scraping bottom here with the running back depth chart. And I thought the Dobbins loss was significant just because he was kind of like a horizontal element to that run game. They used him on some fly sweep type stuff, lined him up as a sort of a motion player. They lose him, and you could be like, well, you know, Gus Edwards, he's a no-nonsense runner. You pair him with Lamar Jackson, you still have something. And they're running out of bodies. Their receivers are hurt. I don't know. This might be a rocky year for a Ravens team that I thought was really right there with Buffalo and some other teams on that sort of second tier in the AFC.
The one positive, from my perspective at least, is that it forces the Ravens to do what essentially any child playing Madden would do, and that is just to sign whoever's left, like to panic and sign whoever's left. Like, there's no coy maneuver at this point, and it's just like, oh, holy crap, let's get Le'Veon Bell and Latavius Murray and, you know, and all these guys. And it reminds me of I had like a running joke with a former colleague when I used to have to back up on the Yankees beat, that there's nothing more that I love than like aging stars or aging like known people who are getting like one last crack at it. And when I used to back up the Yankees, it was like every October they would bring in like a 41-year-old Kerry Wood or like Lance Berkman to do like one very menial task for the team. And it was just like they always had me come in that day because it was my favorite day to just like go up to Lance Berkman and talk to Lance Berkman about being old. And this is kind of what the Ravens are at this point, is like, you know, it's like, okay, you know, every, you know, who else can come in here? And, you know, I saw some people making a joke that, like, oh, well, they haven't brought in Jamaal Charles yet, but, like, I don't think we're far off here, like, or Marshawn Lynch, or, like, you know, I think we could slowly kind of be inching into that territory, especially if the Ravens are still good and they're going to, you know, need some depth at the position.
It's going to be tough.
I don't mean that they're going to bring in Jamaal Charles, but like someone, yes. Know, someone like that.
Yeah, I mean, look, Le'Veon Bell, Todd Gurley, that's the store they're shopping at right now, and it's a tough store to be in on September 10th. Mm-hmm. All right, guys, we are back at it Monday morning. We're going to be recapping all of the Sunday action, as we will all season. So, I don't know. I think we're done ripping Connor for the Brown stuff.
Are
for
we?
Now. What's going to be really interesting is, what if the Browns do win the Super Bowl?
So this is exactly what I was just going to bring up. So I'm going to have to the actual printed prediction is that they will lose to the Packers in the Super Bowl. But now if they win the Super Bowl, like, it's just going to be so much worse. And so theoretically, I'm rooting for them to now not even make the Super Bowl. To validate the prediction, because now I just want it all to go away. I'm, you know,
you want the controversy to be over.
I'm like, did you ever see the Steven Glass movie, Shattered Glass? You know that one?
I haven't seen it, but I know it.
The plagiarizer guy, yeah. At the New Republic, and like everything's, his back's against the wall, and he's, you know, just hoping the whole thing's gonna go away. Like, that's kind of where I'm at now. So like maybe the Browns just don't play this season, and then it just lets me off the hook for everything, you know, like that, like Kevin Stefanski's like, we're not going to play in 2021.
We're focusing on 22.
Yeah. And then I just have another shot to get it right. So.
All right. We'll see how that plays out, and we will see you guys on Monday morning. The MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast is Jenny Frentis, Connor Orr, and me, Gary Gramling. We are produced by Shelby Royson. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. And thanks, as always, to senior podcast producer Dan Bloom. Hi, Dan. We know you listen to the show every week. Mark Moravik is emeritus editor of the MMQB. Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to this feed on Apple Podcasts. And once you do, please leave a rating and review, because it really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.